worrying. You knew that I love you, oh, how I love you. Sitting in la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Sitting in la la, waiting for my ya-ya. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming out. Sitting here la la, waiting for my ya ya. I'm sitting here la la, waiting for my ya ya. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming on. Baby, hurry, don't make me worry.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, before we jump into today's show, here's a reminder that our KBOO membership drive is going on now through September 20th. KBOO, as you know, is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Until now, we have relied on $110,000 in grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Since CPB is closing, those funds will not be available for 2026. This is difficult and frustrating, but together we can keep the station alive and thriving for years to come. It's already been 56 years and counting, but we need your support to continue delivering quality independent programming. So please go to the link and help us reach our $45,000 fundraising goal. Just go to kboo.fm/give to provide some support, whatever you can afford. That's kboo.fm/give. Thank you. Well, folks, Sober October is right around the corner, and that's one solid month of abstaining from a toxic habit. What a good idea. The book we shall be discussing today provides practical wisdom and support needed to sustain real change 1 month at a time. You'll get actionable tools, daily encouragement, and the why insights related to your changing mind and body. You'll discover not just how to step away from alcohol for a month, but also how to change your relationship with alcohol and other habits for good. Our guest today is Charlene Bjorklund, author of the new book, 1 Month Sober, The Day-by-Day Guide to Uneffing Your Relationship with Alcohol, co-authored by Dale Reese at LCSW. Well, hello, Char, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for having me. I'm a fan of your show.
Well, thank you. That's awesome. And Well, you know, this is such an interesting book, 1 month sober, and I want to get the backstory on this. So, how did this happen? Okay, what is your relationship with alcohol such that this book came about?
Alcohol, I have a frenemy sort of relationship with alcohol. I used it in ways that were probably unhealthy to numb myself because I told myself throughout most of my life that I was tough, I could do it on my own, I was fearless, that sort of thing. And really, I would rely on alcohol to get through simple things like my social anxiety. And I, as it turns out, I'm a much more sensitive person than I thought I was. So I had done many sober Octobers and dry Januaries throughout my life because I had this conflict brewing within me, which was I didn't have the tools to deal with my anxiety. I'm kind of the reigning queen of anxiety, really. And I didn't really have the tools to deal with that. I didn't realize social anxiety was a thing, and I didn't realize that I had it. So I kept kind of going back to alcohol to numb myself. So knowing that it was unhealthy, I would do a dry January or a sober October. But I wanted material that would support me in that. And I found that all the books were about people who were really problem drinkers. Their lives were falling apart. I would listen to drunkalogue sort of memoirs, and I could identify with them up to a certain point, and then they would have these rock bottoms that I just never had. So I thought, where's the book for me that someone who's questioning their drinking or just wants to take a break, but still you want to know, I wanted to know why I felt certain ways on certain days and why I tended to fall off the wagon on day 11. I don't know. I just didn't understand any of that and why it happened that way. So I just started doing a ton of research, and I have a great relationship with Dale. Dale is actually my mother and also a therapist in the Portland area. So when I got through, let's see, I was doing research at the end of last year, and I got the idea, write the book you want. And I binge watch Andrew Huberman videos, and he's very nerdy. What is he? Professor of neurobiology and ophthalmology at Stanford. And I was watching one about the AMCC part of your brain and how it impacts willpower, and how every time you make a promise to yourself and you don't follow through on it, it depletes your willpower and kind of erodes your will to a certain extent. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've been doing this to myself all these years. I kept breaking promises to myself. And that's when it really clicked to me that I needed to stay sober for longer because every time I went back to drinking, I felt like I was breaking a promise to myself. I think not everyone is in that boat. It's just where I landed for myself.
So this whole idea of making agreements with yourself and promises that you may or may not keep, is this very central to your approach that you are promoting in this book?
Absolutely. In the beginning, it really is about however long the person decides they want to be sober, and that it is important for them to pick a time. And even if they need to take a little break, like for a day in the middle of the month or something like that, plan that ahead of time. Because if they don't do that, they're going to be making the decision whether or not to drink every single day. And that takes a ton of energy to be making those decisions, or multiple times throughout the day. So yes, I really encourage people to have a time, like a timeline, whether it's 1 month or a couple weeks, 6 months, whatever it is.
And so, just getting more philosophical for a second, why do humans have such a tight relationship with alcohol?
Ooh, it gives us so many wonderful feelings in the beginning. I did so much research about this because I was like, what is it? Why am I obsessed with this stuff? Like, it doesn't taste that great, although I convinced myself that it does. It stimulates a bunch of really feel good neurochemicals. So you get some serotonin, dopamine, GABA, you get endorphins, and all of that makes, I can only speak for myself, makes me feel euphoric in the beginning. And part of my issue with it was that after that initial euphoric feeling, I started, you get a little bit of a depressant quality. So it slows your heart rate, it slows your thinking. And then your body starts giving you some adrenaline, cortisol, and that stuff tends to stay in your system longer. So I would wind up going to sleep happy and relaxed, and then waking up with my heart racing. And that was really what when I started questioning, why am I doing this?
So, okay, what would you say is the interrelationship between alcohol and depression?
It does give you, so the euphoric feeling, I'm sure, is a relief from depression, at
Right.
least initially.
Right.
But then the stress and anxiety that you get on the tail end of it as the alcohol wears off feeds into issues like anxiety and depression. And it makes it so much worse. When I was still drinking, I thought my anxiety would be unmanageable without alcohol. And as it turns out, my anxiety is decreased by so much without alcohol. I just had to make it through those first few weeks, and the anxiety was lifting as my body found homeostasis.
And are you in a place right now where you drink or not drink? I mean, have what's your history of on and off? Okay, and not only that, what is your favorite type of alcohol? I think it must, I think we kind of get addicted to a certain thing. They used to say that we get addicted to a certain cigarette. It's like back in the day when people smoked cigarettes. Are you a Marlboro or a Virginia Light or whatever, So was it, what was your favorite alcohol back in the day?
It was a very hoppy IPA.
Okay.
Very Pacific Northwest of me to love that. Also a good dry white, like a Chardonnay, and occasionally a dirty martini.
Okay.
So depending on the day. And yes, I kind of forgot the first part of the question, but that's
Well, I was just wondering, I've often wondered. I mean, if you just change, like for instance, if you smoke Marlboros and you decide you want to quit smoking, maybe one, half step would be to start smoking menthols or something that you don't really like. Does that apply?
well, I think some people try that, and that actually did kind of work for me sometimes. If I tried a beer that was just not hoppy enough or something like that, I'd be like, "Oh, this is just sad beer. I don't even want to drink it." But I guess I would still get some of the euphoria from it, but I didn't get the whole package of, "Oh, it's delicious, and I get the euphoria." So that is one way to do it. I would just say I would caution people not to do something like, ooh, if I want to drink, I have to drink something really strong, like straight vodka, because then you're just going straight into getting just a blast of a lot of alcohol. So going to something that's a little more tame, like a beer is, or wine, is a little easier way to taper.
Okay, so getting back to the question about depression, it seems like what I'm understanding is that alcohol relieves depression for a little while, but then it makes it worse at the end of the day or in the morning. Does that sound about right?
Yes, that's about right. It's you'll have you'll have depleted serotonin and your dopamine. The more you often you use alcohol, the less accessible your dopamine's going to be. It's kind of like you start creating a narrower and deeper rut as far as what you want or what gives you dopamine.
I see.
And then also serotonin, you'll get a little bit of a drop the next day, but with repeated use, you start getting less and less constantly. That big bummer for depression for sure.
Yeah, it's not helpful. It's probably not helpful for anxiety either, for the same reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I know the difference between anxiety and depression. They seem so linked.
Oh. Yeah, they are for a lot of people. And for me, I guess I'm lucky that I really experienced the anxiety side without the depression side. But it does, alcohol made my anxiety so much worse. And I wish I had figured it out sooner that it did make it worse, and that it was really only a temporary sort of band-aid for underlying issues that I was having, such as just being a sensitive person, and having social anxiety and needing to take frequent breaks from social situations, and even just going into a room that has like a weird sound in it will make me feel kind of off for a second. So knowing now, having that self-awareness, makes me a less anxious person. And I think I was just masking it before with alcohol.
Okay. Do you see yourself ever having another drink in your life?
Probably not. I can't really think of a good reason to have a drink now.
Usually people drink to celebrate with somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. And now the few drinks that I had, so I wanted to test the book before I sent it out. And I'm sure some people are going to be like, why did you do this? But I drank for a month. I had been sober for 4 months, and then I drank for a month to make sure that I was kind of back to my baseline, and then quit with the book and day by day experienced it. And it was pretty accurate. Like it was strikingly accurate.
How does a person tell if they have AUD, alcohol use disorder, which used to simply be called alcoholism? But how does a person know if they have, does it really matter that they know? I mean, what's the metric?
It's so hard to figure that out. That was one of the things that I was doing every time I did a dry January or working up to a dry January. I'd be wondering, do I have an alcohol use disorder? And I would try this test and that test. And most of them were linked to recovery centers. And so there would be, you know, did you get more than three of these questions? Did you answer positively to three or more of these questions? And it's like, has alcohol use interfered with your job? Have you lost relationships over it? Have you had a DUI? Things like that, that felt really severe. And I think for me, what it was more about was, is your alcohol use out of alignment with your values? And for me, that was the case. And that's what I'm hoping people can find through the book is what are your values, and can you use alcohol in a way that doesn't pull you away from your values? And I, for example, for me, I really love people and I love being present with people. So when I realized that I had been present, but not actively engaged, not actively present with, say, my family members that I love, I realized, yes, I love them, but maybe they don't realize that I love them because my behavior isn't in alignment with my values or what's important to me.
I see. Well, that's a really clear example. Let's talk about withdrawal. And that seems to be the big obstacle for people to become free from this particular form of addiction. What are the possible withdrawal symptoms, physically and psychologically?
Yeah. There are mild symptoms, which include anxiety, shakiness, loss of appetite. Let's see. I'm going to go to my book because I'm going to make sure I'm not repeating myself. I tend
That's
to do
okay.
that. Sugar cravings, and then trouble sleeping is a big one for a lot of people. And that's because of alcohol stimulates GABA, and that is a calming, and glutamate, and it opposes glutamate, and glutamate's very exciting. It's a brain excitatory, I think. Anyway, and then there are more serious withdrawal symptoms like elevated blood pressure, elevated heart rate. Delirium tremens is the worst one, which is temporary psychosis, and then hallucinations and seizures are also part of that. So those are the really scary ones where I'm like, please get into a hospital, get yourself into a medically supervised withdrawal.
Right. Now, you've done so much research, and I have to ask this question, and I'm not sure that the research reveals the answer to this question, but I'm wondering, does alcohol use disorder differ by gender? What are the stats on that?
Oh, I'm not sure exactly. Just from my experience, I've seen, like in the rooms of programs, I've seen there are more men in a lot of the programs, maybe except for Women for Sobriety, obviously. But it does seem like men and women do get to kind of different places. Like for women, it seems like they will get into a kind of an auto accident or get, it'll hit them a little faster. Like they can't go as many years abusing alcohol as men can. And it might just be because of how we metabolize alcohol differently.
You have a term that you bring up in the book that is pretty significant. It's called pre-commitment. And you write, this is a quote, "If you rely on willpower rather than pre-commitment, your willpower will deplete, leaving you vulnerable to decision fatigue and choosing the easy out." Okay, what do you mean by pre-commitment? And how is that different than just believing in willpower?
Right. Pre-commitment is me saying, I will not drink for this month, period. There is no question mark there. There's no option to talk myself out of it. And that way, it requires almost no willpower. I can wake up every morning and say, yep, it's still October and I'm still not drinking, and I don't have to decide not to drink today. The decision was made 5 days ago when I decided that I wasn't going to drink. And it just takes this idea of decision fatigue, and it just kicks it right out the door. You can decide 100 other things today, but you don't have to decide whether or not you're drinking. You're pre-committed to the idea.
And do you think this should be a written document between you and yourself?
Yes, I think it should be. And that is something that in the beginning of the book, we make space for that. How long do you intend to remain sober? And there are times throughout the book, times like day 11 for me was problematic. So on day 11, it's, if you need a reminder of why you're doing this, go back to this page and look at what you wrote before you started this. Because we do all need those reminders.
Okay, but alcohol is not, okay, this is an argument. Alcohol is not the problem. Alcohol is a symptom, or it's a way of self-medicating for a problem. I'm wondering if there's a way to, how important is it to have a substitute for the substance? Like, I remember when I quit smoking cigarettes, which was a long, long, long time ago, but I decided that I was going to carry toothpicks and lifesavers with me wherever I went. And I used toothpick as a oral substitute for sticking something in my mouth. But how important is it to have a substitute for alcohol, in your opinion?
I think a lot of people wind up eating a lot of ice cream in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
I think part of it is because It is a mood booster. You're getting nice sugar and it's delicious and all that good stuff. And there's really nothing wrong with that. So a lot of people do wind up leaning on sugar in the beginning because it does also give you dopamine and a lot of the feel good stuff that alcohol also gives you, but without the addictive qualities.
Okay. Although sugar is addicting.
Yeah, it's true. It is.
You talk about negativity bias and what you call the disease voice, you know, and you, one of the things you say is, I can never trust the first thing my mind tells me in the morning. And I'm very curious about this because I have the same issue come up for me. I wake up in the morning and for some reason I'm depressed.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, and I'm sorry to hear that. But it happens to me too. And it's usually like, oh, I call it my gremlin. It's the voice is my gremlin, and I'm laying there, and it's like, oh, you have to do this thing today. You don't like doing this thing. It's going to be hard. What are you going to have for breakfast? Oh, making breakfast is such a pain. Why are you, you know, why do you have to do that? And wouldn't it be great if someone could bring you coffee? No one's going to bring you coffee. You got to go get your coffee. And all of this is before my toes even touch the ground. So to counter the gremlin voice, I try to lean right into gratitude first thing in the morning. I go, you know, my body feels pretty good today. Look at it, it's sunny outside already. You know, just anything I'm grateful for. Oh, my children, my family, whatever. Grateful for anything. And that tends to tone it down and it sets my day going the right direction. Although I still have to say, until that first cup of coffee is kicked in, I'm usually about half gremlin, half gratitude.
Right. So that's why it's important to have someone bring you your coffee in the morning.
Absolutely.
What are other nutritional approaches to combat alcohol cravings?
So sugar is one that a lot of people lean on.
Right.
I also like probiotics are great. The gut is your second brain. So let your gut help your mind. So I use a great probiotic. Magnesium helped me sleep in the beginning when I was having a really tough time. What else did I do? Oh, lots of B vitamins, just because those can be very relaxing. And those happen to be, magnesium and B vitamins happen to be things that people who typically drink heavier kind of run low on. And also potassium. Drinking a lot of electrolytes in the beginning was helpful to me just because it made my body just feel so good. And it was probably just giving me all the electrolytes that I had been losing because I was drinking a diuretic all the time.
Right, right. So how is taking a 1 month fast a good strategy? I mean, is this just strictly a strategy for someone who wants to completely quit drinking? Is there any good reason to keep drinking at all?
A lot of the reason would just be social in general, or it could be part of your religion or anything. But health-wise, there's not really a great reason to drink, but it can be fun. And for anyone who can use alcohol moderately, I celebrate that for them. But taking a break is also just a good way to remind yourself of why you enjoy alcohol and put it in its place in your life. And it may have no place in your life, or it might have spot there.
Well, I want to thank you, Char, because there's so much more we could explore, but we have just run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, as well as to encourage them to get your book. The website is www.bodyanddry.com. Now, body and dry is all one word. BAWDY, body, AND, dry. So that's all one word, .com. And I encourage people to go there and check out your work. And I want to thank you for doing it. And I want to thank you for being on our show.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
And for those who may have tuned in to Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien. Now, don't worry. You can play and share this entire interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. And I'll tell you how in a minute. And we're going to give Char links to this as well, so that her it will be available via her website. Today, we've been visiting with Charlene Bjorklund, co-author of 1 Month Sober, The Day-by-Day Guide for Unethic, Your Relationship with Alcohol. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast via www.kboo.fm. in Portland, Oregon. And perhaps you subscribe to our podcast for free, which you can find at divination.com, which is spelled divination.com, as well as by searching Pathways Radio on Paulo's YouTube channel, where you can give us a thumbs up and subscribe. So please, any way you want, feel free to forward a link to your friends. We here at the KBOO Community Radio want to assure our listeners that despite losing federal public radio grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we will continue to unapologetically represent the voices of our community. And with the loss of $110,000 of federal funding, we are counting on supporters like you to help make up the loss. So
you're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.